And welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek. I'm Oren.
I'm Grace.
I am David.
And I don't know if I should still introduce him as a guest, but here's Bob.
You know, we really gotta stop meeting like this.
It's
He's
true.
our long-term guest.
People are gonna start talking, and it's just no one likes a headline.
People will say we're in love.
All right. So, getting this show started, a couple of administration things to take care of. You can still nominate us for the podcast awards at the
Oh,
podcastawards.com.
stop, 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 stop,
Yeah.
stop. Okay. You need to be way more excited when you announce something
Give us
like
a little
this.
pep here, Oren.
Like,
Are you
hey
going?
guys, we are totally being nominated. What is it again? Nominated for the podcast award thing?
Yeah.
All right, you gotta be
Oh,
more upbeat about
hey.
this.
Look, I was upbeat about it when I first announced it. This is just a reminder that it's still going.
But you gotta be upbeat
Keep
about
upbeat,
it.
Oren.
Otherwise, it's boring and a chore, and no one likes those things, and then no one will vote for you.
Upbeat, or I beat up you.
Oh dear, oh dear.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't gonna resort to physical threats, but.
It's implicit with you, Bob. We all know. All
And
right.
there are 3 days left to 3 days left for nominations. The nomination window closes at the on the 15th, so get it
Show us
done.
that you love us.
Yeah, so
Do
that's the
it.
thing. That thing is still happening. Star Trek Continues is doing a Kickstarter for their next episode, and
Woo!
yeah, I really like Star Trek Continues. And with some news recently about who might be doing the next Star Trek TV series, I like them more than I did before. So that's happening.
Suddenly, my
Lightning.
idea for 20-year hiatus looks so bad now, doesn't it?
I'm starting to consider it.
Well, wait, what's this news?
Okay, non-breaking news. This isn't like certain,
Bring
but
you the best news from yesterday, all things Trek.
what we know is that there have been some tweets indicating that Robert Orci is in talks with CBS to make a new Star Trek series.
Okay.
Which, I mean, maybe that could
Yay.
work.
Yay.
Yeah, I
With the
mean, who
question
knows?
marks.
Like, we might get a Transformers Prime situation where we had a.
Hey now. Hey
Yep.
now.
That's what I'm saying. No, it is a good thing, Grace. I know
Yeah.
you like Transformers
Okay, cool.
Prime. I've heard nothing but good things about Transformers Prime, but it's also written by Orci and Kurtzman, who also did the Transformers movies, and the Transformers movies were terrible. And I don't think the Star Trek movies were terrible. I just think they had
No.
bad stories. Which will become way more apparent in a TV series, I think. But maybe with the TV series, they'll do what they did with Transformers Prime, which is make a good story despite the problems the movies had.
Did you ever watch any actual Transformers Prime?
No. No, I didn't.
You're making assumptions then.
You said you liked it. I'm going off what other people have told you.
I do like it. I like it a lot. I'm just wondering if it would meet Oren's standards.
For a Transformers story? Probably. I have lower standards for Transformers than I do for Star Trek. It's,
Ouch.
you know,
Wow.
just how it is. All right.
Oren, you are going to get some hate for that.
That might be.
Mostly from me.
That's possible, and I'm prepared. You could send that hate mail to allthingstrek@hotmail.com.
Congratulations, I'm going to tie you down and force you to watch more Beast Wars now.
I love Beast Wars.
Everyone likes Beast Wars!
I didn't.
Well, you
Damn
can send your
I thought it was so dumb.
you can send your hate mail too. No. All right, so
Chat room agrees with me.
that's probably true. The chat room likes you more than it likes me, Grace. We already established this.
I love you, chat room.
The other thing is that we are going to be trying to take All Things Trek to a 1 hour format, and we'll see how that works. We still have the option of going long if we have to, but we're going to try to shake things up and see if we can make them better than they were before. So that's the plan. Everyone has been, informed.
All the same goodness with half the calories.
Exactly.
Half the inane babble, you mean?
Or maybe I'm just convincing you to pay me the same amount for a smaller package. Who knows? We'll see. So, all right. We have one email before we get to the first of our Star Trek movie review series. This email is from Data Logan, and it is titled NYC. The City on the Edge of Forever is an interesting case. Some versions of the script said it took place in Chicago. Dialogue was left appropriately vague so that the story could take place in any major US city around that time. But the show ended up filming the episode of a standing lot that was dressed as New York City. So while the dialogue of the episode doesn't pin down the city, the stage dressing does. Most significant set dressing is the poster on a wall for a boxing match between Kid McCook and Mike Manson at the Madison Square Gardens. And he gives a little link to that picture. The DS9 episode, Past Tense Part 2, is an episode where characters travel back in time to time frames prior to the production date. You forgot to mention this in your podcast about such episodes, but it's forgivable since the time traveling back to those periods was pretty minor. Really, only Kira and O'Brien very briefly traveling. Of note, though, is the poster seen on the wall for a boxing match between Kid McCook, and Mike Mason at Bayland Garden. The posters also mention that it is the first fight between these two, since their earlier fight at Madison Square Garden. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, homage.
Ah.
Sweet.
It's true.
And they got all the way to San Francisco for a second fight.
I had forgotten about DS9 Past Tense, but then again, like he says, that was only about 30 seconds, so I'm willing to forgive myself. And it's a good reference there, Data Logan. I certainly wouldn't have caught that. Now, Data Logan also sent us a voicemail, which we will play at the end of the show, now that it's done haunting my computer.
It was great. It was playing on loop.
I turned off iTunes and it was playing in, and it just kept playing. iTunes wasn't even in my Taskmaster anymore. So, you know, there's that.
It was there. It took on a life of its own. Now Data Logan is the ghost in your machine.
So look forward to the end of the episode for that one.
I can think of worse things than the computer consistently spewing Star Trek stuff at you.
Yeah, worse things have happened. And I mean, it's a good email. I enjoyed listening to it. I just didn't know if I wanted to listen to it for, like, you know, the rest of forever.
Maybe this is what the inside of Data Logan's head is like.
Just constant repeats of various views on different Star Trek topics. I could see that.
Just constant criticisms. Wait, that's what in Orin's head is like.
Oh, rude.
Oh.
All right. So this is...
No, kid, because I love.
You say
Orin.
That.
I say it and I mean it most of the time.
All right, so this is the first of our movie review series in which we are reviewing Star Trek, the motion picture. And in this honor of this movie, this review will take 5 hours.
Oh, dear.
I didn't plan that much time in advance.
Yeah, well...
especially on the motion picture.
All right, so I divided the review into 8 different categories, which I think is a pretty good breakdown of how the movie did.
Mm-hmm.
First, I'd like to talk about the visual effects, and to a certain extent, the sound effects.
Well, there was a minimal amount of lens flare.
That's true. That's a good thing.
That was a great start.
I enjoy the underhanded reference that we're making here.
benefited from a little lens flare. It would have made everything look less visually flat.
Yeah, there is that.
There was the lens flare on the plasma ED torpedo thing after the meteor shot.
I think the lesson we've all learned today is that it's important to moderate your lens flare.
I think the lesson we learned today is that you should try to make your sets pop a little bit better, because that's like... The thing that really stood out to me as being really bad visually is the inside of the Enterprise, because everything is gray.
Like, I think the problem is they were still I interrupted.
No, go ahead.
I think the problem is they were still working sort of with the visual sense of what it would look like for TV if they made those sets, but on the big screen, on video, it just doesn't work the same way it would for television.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's actually a really, really good point, because the motion picture, you know, was the motion picture, and then it was actually Star Trek Phase 2.
Yeah.
And it switched back and forth a number of times before it actually became a movie. But mm-hmm. some production work had already started before the movie was declared a movie.
Right. Yeah. And you saw the same problem in Generations, which we'll get to in a few weeks.
Give us time.
A TV mentality applied to a movie. But yeah. I also think part of that is actually the reverse, because if you look at the original TOS films, or not films, excuse me, episodes, everything is very brightly colored. Like, you have the red, blue, and yellow uniforms, you have the bright lights on the bridge, whereas in this movie, like I said, everything is gray.
Well, we've got someone pointing out, Make Tea Not War in the chat room is saying maybe the interior was blander to make the uniforms stand out more.
And those uniforms didn't need any help to stand out.
They were pretty loud uniforms.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, sort of. I mean... They
didn't need the extra emphasis, really.
Well, I mean, again, the uniforms are loud in that they basically... They hug in all the wrong places, is sort of a nice way to put it. But their actual coloring is very boring.
they're all like white,
like grays and beige.
You know, it's like we give...
Even the alien chick just gets a white miniskirt.
Yeah, I mean, we gave, you know, the Star Trek Into Darkness movie some grief for having very monotone uniforms, but at least those were well-tailored.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this is like worst of both worlds. You have
And they had matching hats. Just saying.
You have, like, the poorly fitted Star Trek uniforms that everyone jokes about, but they're not even pretty to look at or colorful. They're just this beige color. And, you know, the white ones that, you know, hug in the wrong places.
So I've always had a burning question about those uniforms.
Yeah.
And granted, I haven't done a lot of research on them because they are not my favorite uniform. They're my least favorite uniform. What are the belt things? What are those?
The belt things?
Yeah. Everyone was wearing, like, this black fanny pack all the time.
Oh, gosh. I don't even
know.
What
was that?
They're Starfleet regulation fanny packs.
Yeah. What is this thing they're all wearing?
Maybe that was a life support belt.
Oh, man!
I seem to recall hearing something somewhere about how Roddenberry didn't like the life support belts. I can't actually quote that, but I seem to recall, so if that's the case, probably not. Maybe that was just an attempt to make the whole thing look more futuristic.
Possible.
Like, there's... Also, apparently we're Skyping in the chat room. I'm sorry for that, guys.
Sorry.
But there's... It sounds like what happened in this movie, part of the problem is that they had a bunch of money suddenly when they hadn't had any money before.
And
they were like...
Spend it?
Yeah, they were like, we need to spend all of this money to make everything look futuristic. So they were like, why not put a weird black thing on everybody's belt that looks all futury? Like, what is that thing for? We'll never know. I mean, you know, they got, like, you know, the same thing with the Ilea bot when they put the red thing in her neck. But to give credit where credit is due, I am a big fan of the opening sequence with the Klingons.
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah. I wanted to touch on that because there is some, even though it's a short sequence, it is kind of very significant for the Klingons for this movie, from what came before and then what comes after. But just real quick about the whole, everything being gray.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what category this would go into, whether it was special effects or the scripts or everything, like pretty much all over. It's a very slow movie at times, like they're long duration shots. And some people don't like that, but I kind of think of it as a different type of movie, a different type of filmmaking that kind of is similar. I'm not going to try to say it's as good or, you know, on par with or whatever, but it's kind of similar to me or reminiscent of like 2001, A Space Odyssey, 2010, where it's like a different approach to scenes and the pacing. And even if in some degrees the sets, because everything is really like white and grays, a lot of blinky lights and stuff. So I kind of, you know, took it in that direction to me, like especially with some of the long lingering scenes that take forever, and you get the like symphonic music behind it, whereas that's a lot different than, you know, today's blockbuster movies where they're using the Beastie Boys and stuff and it's quick paced and fast cuts. You know, this is a slower movie film. Well, it's not a dissing so much, it's just definitely a different style, a different pace and
definitely
approach.
Well, and here's the thing on that is, we're skipping categories already, but that's fine. It's not that movies always have to be fast-paced, right? I mean,
right.
Wrath of Khan is not a fast-paced movie. There's just no doubt about it. Movies can be slow-paced. And I would argue that the first scene of this movie with the Klingons, especially the visuals, that works very well. That scene is pretty slow-paced. Like, stuff's not whizzing past your head and flying, but... it's a well-made sequence, and it works at the pacing that they have it. I'm going to get to the more of the pacing a little bit later, but I really liked the way the Klingon ships were filmed. Like, the close-ups that they did made them look really menacing. And, of course, you know, it was the first time we had Klingon ridges, so that's cool. Sorry, go ahead.
And it was the Klingon ships got some beauty treatment because when they're very first introduced, you see the three of them, and then it, you know, it comes towards you and comes towards you, and then the camera does this sweeping turn as it like passes under you and then goes from behind. But I thought it was really cool to get that treatment and the close-ups, because while they're reminiscent of Klingon ships from the original series, the D7 classic ships, and then these are technically, I guess, would still be D7s, but you know they're updated for the movie, and they got all these because the Klingon D7 battle cruisers and TOS were very smooth on the hull, like very smooth curvy lines and contours. Where these ships follow the same basic shape and structure, but there's all these little bits and pieces and you know sticky out component. Like it's very texture filled on top of the, you know, it's not like the Enterprise where everything is smooth lines and angle and curves. It's like very utilitarian. Like you can imagine all those little bits sticking out are like, you know, compressors and generators and whatever else. It's like a lot of, you know, physical texturing onto the ships. And then with the Klingon, the first time we see Klingon ridges, which is a departure from the TOS, and also the Klingon uniforms. Now they have the iconic, you know, leather and steel and fur, the Klingon uniforms we see going later, which I don't know why they got away from the gold lame. I think they still should have incorporated some of the gold lame from TOS.
It's like a warrior's fabric, though, doesn't it?
It's the first thing that comes to my mind, I'll tell you what.
If you work it right.
You've seen too many drag queens, Bob.
Well, they're fierce, you know, at times. But it's also the first time we also see some Klingon language. And yeah. At this point, it's not the Mark Okrand language, but it's definitely the first time we see Klingons speaking their own language. Because in the original series, all we ever heard was names. And then, you know, that one Korak says, oh, they're half the galaxy's learning Klingonese, but we never hear it in the TOS series. So now they're speaking in Klingon. That dialogue was created by James Doohan, Scotty, which basically at that time was just like gibberish, you know, like they always do in sci-fi movies, like, you know, Greedo and Jabba from Star Wars. They're just saying weird sounds and saying it's a language and then put subtitles under it. But that became later on used in Mark Okrand's language. So it's very cool for the Klingons. We get to see the ridges for the first time. And the Klingon commander is Mark Leonard, who was Sarek, and also Romulan commander in TOS. So it's like he completes the trifecta of the TOS primary aliens, Romulan, Vulcan, Klingon. And I just like the idea that here's Klingons out on patrol, and they see this cloud, and then let's shoot torpedoes at it. Let's, like, what is this thing? Let's find out what happens when we hit torpedoes and it doesn't go so well. But
yeah.
And so then we get the iconic, what's that?
Nothing. So you're saying was this a big movie amongst the Klingon fans, you think?
To some degree. I mean, it was very influential because again, also we get the Klingon anthem, you know, for the music that we see during the Klingon ships. That got carried on in the regular, in the subsequent TOS movies. It got used in, you know, DS9. All the times you see that they reference Klingons, you get that iconic, recognizable Klingon battle anthem theme. So even though it was very short at the beginning, it did, like, you know, do a lot of firsts and a lot of things that would be carried on afterwards. So I think that's kind of the best part of the movie. And then after that, it all goes downhill from there.
Actually, pretty much what I was saying. And another thing about the visuals is that there are certain parts where they overdo it. Like the inside of V'ger is really, it looks more like a kaleidoscope than a ship. Like, you know, I'm trying to figure out, like, I'm looking at it and I'm just like, this does not look like the inside of a spaceship. There's way too much open space, for one thing. And then there's all these random images that I have a really hard time figuring out what that's all supposed to be. And it's just like, you know, it's bewildering.
Starfleet was trying to go in a new direction. Didn't really work out for them.
Yeah, I guess. And then, of course, the scene where Spock, like, flies in inside the orifice, which maybe they shouldn't have called it that, but they did. And he flies into it with his spacesuit, and he sees, like, an acid trip, as far as I can tell. Like, it's not even a ship anymore. Now he's just seeing random images. And I'm like, what is even happening?
He's just tripping out, man.
Yeah.
Just tripping out.
Oh, and,
maybe it was the same people who did the, you know, the little boat in Willy Wonka or something. Who knows?
And Make Tea Not War in the chat room told us that in the novel, those little black boxes you were asking about, those are apparently health monitors.
Health monitors?
Yep.
What did like flash red if you're having a problem or something?
Did it verbally
alert people that you were having a problem?
if you died, you could put in a little quarter to continue. That's a thing that would happen.
More quarters to continue.
Is there like the health command central or something like that? That's in sickbay or something? That's got like everyone's readout?
There were a lot of weird things in that novelization, apparently. I'm just telling you what Make Tea Not War told me.
Why would the internet lie to us?
Look, I trust our chat room. Maybe I shouldn't. Maybe that's a terrible mistake.
They bring up the novelization, and I was gonna wonder to ask you guys: did you like go? Are you just working off of the memories from the past, or did you like specifically rewatch the movie for this episode? Because when I went, I watched it again, but then I noticed that there's a couple different versions of it. There was the original 1979 theatrical release. Mm-hmm. Then there's a director's cut, which is what I watched, and then there's the remastered one that includes. You know, different stuff. So I watched the director's cut. Which ones did you guys watch?
I've seen all of them.
I think the only one I saw was the theatrical release version.
Yeah, I think I've seen both. I rewatched the director's cut because that's the one I have on DVD. And I think the director's cut is supposed to be better. Like, I've been told they made some changes. The only one I know of is that they changed the size of the cloud. It was originally supposed to be 82 AUs, which would make it like, you know, four times the size of the Earth's solar system. And they changed it to 2 AUs. Something like that.
That's what he says. Because when I watched it, he said it's 2 AUs. And I even looked up again what a AU was. But then the thing I've...
Bob, you go ahead.
The size of the cloud isn't really all that important because the size of the vessel is what's important. I mean, the cloud is just a cloud. The cloud dissipated before it got to Earth anyway.
Right. I mean, it was the thing about the cloud that I wasn't sure about was that I'm not clear what the Klingons thought they were firing at. Like, I don't know if the Klingons could detect that there was a ship in there and they were trying to hit it, or if they were just, you know, like, shooting into a cloud and randomly hoping that they would kill something.
Well, you know, like on the Next Generation, and every time they would come up on an anomaly, they would be like, you know, prepare a probe. Let's see what our sensors detect from shooting a probe into this thing. It's kind of the same idea, except with a torpedo.
Yeah, who knows? It's like, we'll send it in there, and if it goes away, we'll know we fixed the problem.
If we lost it, we know we're in trouble.
A funny note on Ileabot's costume, because, you know, she gets beamed... Ileabot, that's what I'm going to call her. she gets beamed in this kind of sexy robe, and you're kind of wondering, why did V'ger send her over in a sexy robe? Like, what was the point of that?
She was visiting her masseuse.
Yeah, apparently what it was supposed to be, or at least according to more internet, is that she was actually supposed to be nude. And then she was supposed to step out of that shower, because for some reason V'ger beamed her into a shower. And then she was supposed to put on this robe that Ilea had just in her quarters for whatever reason. Because, you know, Ilea likes sexy robes, I guess.
Well, yeah, that's exactly how the sequence plays out in the movie.
No, in the movie
she comes in nude.
No, in the director's cut, at least, she comes in with the robe on.
Well, that's wrong.
No, because I just watched this. What basically happens is they send the Ilea bot in. Don't know if it was Kirk's quarters, but they send her to like an office or some room. They rush in and it looks like she's in a shower filled with like lights and energy.
Yeah.
And you could just barely see a form. And then when they do a close up of her, she's basically nude because you see her neck and her shoulders and like her clavicle, and then it like cuts off. So you could definitely see that she's not wearing a top, or at least it's like a tube top that don't go up high. But then she's talking.
Shoulders.
And then Kirk hits a button on the wall, and when she steps out, she's in the robe. So I thought, did Kirk just like beam that robe onto her? Like, why did Kirk hit a button on the wall? That was to unlock
buff, though.
It's like the Jetsons. It's the automatic dressing machine.
I'm sorry, what was that, Grace?
Why would they send her over in the buff, though?
Well, the implication was that V'ger, because V'ger doesn't understand humans, doesn't know what clothes are, right? And so the idea was that V'ger replicated Ilea as a robot and sent her over, and then they were like, put some clothes on because we're ashamed of your feminine body. But
very forbidden planet right there, yeah.
Yeah, but apparently the actress didn't want to do that nude scene, and so they had her come out in the robe instead of putting it on after she came out. So maybe the robe was, like, hanging in the shower? I like the idea that this is Kirk's quarters. I don't remember if it actually was.
I don't think so.
That is the worst possible place you could send a naked woman to.
I mean, or the best from Kirk's perspective, I guess. I don't know.
Kirk's ship, his rules.
I like the idea of Kirk having that robe in his shower. I am more and more excited by this the more we talk about it.
Well, and I was confused by why did Kirk hit a button on the wall right before she comes out? Like, if it was to unlock the shower door, you'd be screwed because you're in there showering and the way to get out is a button on the wall way across the room. It's like, I didn't know what he was doing.
Maybe there's another button on the inside.
Well, if
okay.
It's Kirk's shower, right, he's got the lock on the outside so he can trap whoever's in there.
If it's Kirk's shower also, does that mean it's his robe?
That's what I want to know. I hope it's his.
Does he have, like, a collection of little short bathrobes?
That's my hope.
To show off his man cleavage, because it was, like, low cut, and then it had the little collar that flips up. Kirk's styling when he gets out the shower.
He really likes to show off his thighs.
Look, we can only hope that that's what happens when Kirk is in his off hours, but...
This is just making him even more like Zap Brannigan, I guess.
I think that robe may have inspired the Zap Brannigan uniform. We'll never... Or, I mean, more likely it was the TNG scant that they had going on. But, you know, who knows?
We don't know, and I'm not sure we want to.
Well, I want to, but we probably never will.
I actually wanted to go back to V'ger.
Yeah, go back to
it. Because you had mentioned that... You know, when you saw the movie, you felt that like you were looking at a kaleidoscope.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I felt like when I first watched the movie years and years ago when I was a kid. You know, mm-hmm. It was on VHS. My dad had recorded it at one point. And I was looking at it. I was like, I don't even know what I was supposed to be looking at. It's like, what is this? I know they're inside of something, but I don't know what it is. Exactly.
I guess it's mysterious.
And the outside...
I don't know if that was necessarily intentional or it's because they just had bad effects. I'm leaning towards the fact that they just had bad effects is what it was.
Or both.
Because
yeah.
In the remastered version, you can very much tell that, yeah, they're inside of a ship is what it is.
Yeah.
You can see it. You got the exterior shots of the Enterprise inside of the V'ger, and it's all good. One of the theories I want to put out there is that maybe because the whole idea... I mean, because they could have sent any ship out there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean... Functionally speaking, they could have sent any starship out there. They specifically wanted to send Kirk because he had experience dealing with this kind of nonsense, where it's just like, there's this thing out here,
Kirk,
we don't know what it is, so we're going to send Kirk and crew out
that's
there.
That's partly that's partly it, because that's why they took over and didn't let Decker continue, because Kirk was saying, like, I've been out there, I've dealt with unknowns. But I was taking a few notes when I wrote it down, and the thing that tripped me out was, so here it's on a direct course for Earth, right? That whole type of thing. But then when he's talking to Scotty, when he's talking to Decker, right, as they fly, you know, are getting ready to launch, he says, an unknown object of unbelievable destructive power is 3 days away from Earth. And I thought, really? There's no other Starfleet vessel close enough to get to Earth in 3 days? They had to rely on an unfinished, refitted Enterprise that still, like, things weren't, you know, operational till Tuesday or type of thing, but...
They're all having a nap, okay? Now, Bob, I want to hear the end of your idea.
Right? So, the whole idea of it being this thing that they don't know anything about, they don't understand it, it's a truly alien thing. Kirk's the only one who's got experience. I mean, Kirk and crew are the only people that have experience with this thing, so that's why they send them out. They cart them out on the Enterprise, which is, like, half done,
mm-hmm.
you know, out there. And such, and it kind of occurs to me that the reason we can't really see the inside of it so well, or we can't, we think it looks like a kaleidoscope, is because it is so alien that we can't understand it originally. I feel might be, it's a theory I'm putting out there. I don't know if the legs are shaking on or whatnot. Maybe that's the idea that they were going for in the first place. And then we have the remastered version, which people come along that remastered, like, yeah, this looks dumb. Let's fix it so it looks like an actual ship.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, if that was the case, I would be okay with it if the characters were like, why does the inside of this ship look like a kaleidoscope?
You know, it's Art Deco. You wouldn't understand.
It's because, like, the characters are looking at it like, this is amazing and awe-inspiring, but not like, what's going on out there? You know, none of them look confused. They all look dumbstruck. And for all I know,
well, even the
was that David?
The outside. I mean, a lot, to me, I took it like once the Enterprise is going further, deeper in, you kind of do start to see weird structures, and there's that like shutter orifice thing that Spock goes through. There is mechanical like stuff
orifice.
In there, but as before they get into that, they're passing by all these like weird, you know, lights and colors and shapes and stuff. And they described it as an energy cloud. And I kind of thought maybe that was just different forms of like the plasmas and the energies that were making up the cloud. But even, I mean, because as they go through that, the effects of the blue lights and all that stuff like takes different shapes. It's not consistently the same thing all the way through. Like as they're going in, the patterns and the shapes and the way it's, you know, presented kind of differs as they kind of, I guess, maybe also to show that they're making progress deeper inside, like the different layers of it. But even from the outside, I always thought it looked kind of cool but weird. And the outside of the V'ger cloud kind of always reminded me of those crazy posters where you're supposed to look at it and see like a sailboat. And I never could see the sailboat.
What was that, Chris?
Those magic eye posters.
Yeah, I can't. Right. I could never find the sailboat either.
It's a schooner.
All right, so if you guys are up for it, I would like to talk about the... Sorry. What was that, Grace? I keep talking over you.
That was your Mallrats reference for the day.
All right. So if you guys are up for it, I would like to talk about the characters, the canon show characters, as it were, and how they were portrayed in this movie. And the only one that I think was portrayed well was McCoy. Right?
Yeah.
And maybe that's just because McCoy is so easy to portray because he's the grumpy doctor.
Right? Oh, engineers, they love to change things.
I mean, you know...
I was happy to see that when they were first introduced, they carried on. I mean, there's the whole thing about he doesn't want to beam over. He wants to take the shuttle, which, you know, is part of his character. But when he finally does show up, he's got an awesome beard and he's got a medallion. And it's like he's like Pimp McCoy. It was just cool.
I'm pretty sure that McCoy, after his time on the original 5-year mission, went off and like lived in a cabin in the mountains trying to hide from like Starfleet NSA, like off the grid. And that's why he didn't want to be beamed anywhere. It's because he's totally buying the idea that's not me anymore on the other side. He's gotten totally conspiracy theories. That's why he's got the beard. I'm pretty sure that's why.
It's everyone knows it's harder to transport you if you have more mass. So if you just grow enough beard, maybe they won't get
But well, I mean, now the point is McCoy is back now and he's ready to party. Or at least for us to.
It's true. And McCoy is, you know, he's good in this movie. He tries to mediate, you know, Kirk and Decker, and he has, like, funny lines. And I like McCoy. You know, McCoy's a pretty solid character no matter what movie he's in.
Yes, the 70s medallion. Thank you, Make T-Not War. Yes. It was so cool.
Wait, hold on, guys. I'm sorry. I have to apologize. We have to rewind a minute. There was a very important thing we forgot to talk about in the visual effects.
Uh-oh.
We forgot to mention the wormhole thing.
Oh
God, I hated that sequence. First of all, because I was very unclear why it was happening, because like they made some reference about going to warp inside a solar system, but then they were like, then they didn't actually say if that was what caused the wormhole to happen.
It was an imbalance in the warp nacelle field energy.
Right. But that was something they had never mentioned before, which is suddenly now there was a problem. And when I first watched it, I didn't even catch that line, and I just thought suddenly they'd run into a wormhole. It's just...
Right, well,
wormholes, they just pop up everywhere, well, you know?
They kind of explain it after it happens, but, you know, they launch out, and it's like, okay, let's go get this big bad cloud thing, and then, oh my God, we're in a wormhole. And I was like, wait, how did this happen? It just seemed to, like, pop up out of nowhere. And then they're flying through, like, this crazy line drawing thing that they're calling a wormhole, and then they're like, there's an object
like
down at the far end.
On me video.
Yeah, and it turns out there's an asteroid in front of them, and they think, you know, Kirk is like, fire the phasers at the asteroid for some reason, and Decker's like, no, don't do that. And here's another thing I noticed. So they're going to, you know, don't shoot the phasers. Those are tied into the engines, which have the imbalance, and so Decker goes to Chekhov and says, fire their torpedoes. And this, I think it's because they're in a wormhole. Chekhov says a W perfectly, which is out of character. He says, photon torpedoes away. And it's I rewound it because they're talking all weird because they're in the wormhole and the lights are trails and, you know, it's all psychedelic and like photon torpedo. But then he says, away. And I'm like, wait a minute, Chekhov. But then, so they destroy the asteroid, and it explodes, and they're out of the wormhole. And I thought, was the asteroid somehow causing it? But then they say, it was the imbalance in our engines, and if we try to go to warp, it'll happen again. And then I thought, well, what did the asteroid have to do with anything if it's the engine? It was just weird.
Well, and like the reason I was so confused is that they specifically bring up the danger of going to warp inside a solar system. They go to warp inside a solar system, and then a completely different thing happens, which causes the wormhole. And it was just like, how many things are wrong with these engines? Like, I don't know. But the reason why I brought this up in the visual effects section is because, and visual and sound effects, is that if you want your drama to be serious, don't make everyone talk like this. It's just not.
And the visual effects of like psychedelic trails and the lights, and it was just trippy.
Yeah, you just can't take that scene seriously. It's so silly sounding.
If we'd heard it like in regular time, would we have heard Chekhov go, "Hang on a minute, everyone. Check my voice out."
Probably. I think what this tells us is that Chekhov has been faking the accent the whole time.
He just wants attention.
That's just a fascinating observation. I nominate David for Trek Nerd Award of the Year.
Yeah, definitely. Maybe he's not actually Chekhov. Maybe he's actually like an American guy named Walter Koenig who doesn't have a Russian accent at all. God,
I don't believe it.
The conspiracy theories. Okay. So I just wanted to, you know, mention the wormhole thing because that scene was terrible. all right, so back to our characters. Were you guys as confused by Spock's arc in this movie as I was?
It was trippy.
So the last time we saw Spock.
Well, what are you confused exactly by? Because okay. I followed it pretty well.
Well, I mean, I know what they said happened, right? But here's the thing.
I know they explained it, but bear with me.
Look, it's a...
Yeah, he heard it. He just doesn't get it.
Look, it's a big...
Well, I was tripped out by it, but I wasn't confused by it.
All right. So it's a well-known... Excuse me. Okay, I lost my train of thought there. All right, so the last time we saw Spock, at like the end of the original series, he was, you know, he was Spock. He was fine. He had his whole "I'm not emotional except sometimes" thing going on. And then at the start,
except when they're not.
At the start of this movie, he's going through a ritual, a very unfortunately named ritual called the Kolinar.
Well, first off, before we see what is he's going through that, we just see him, and he looks like hippie Spock. He's got this long hair that's like not cut right, and it's like, because in the series, he's like got the very, you know, tightly trimmed and neatly combed bowl cut. This time it's like, whoa, Spock, what's with your hair and your robes and you're all hippie?
Much of the character and costume design of this movie is a tragic attempt at making everyone a little more hip.
Yeah, that's
horribly wrong.
I mean, it shows why, you know, it shows like the definite fashion influences of the time, right? That did not age very well.
Fashion such as it was.
But so he's getting all of his emotions purged, and I was like, why is he doing that? He seemed fine, and now it seems like he has this problem where he feels he's too emotional. And so then the rest of the movie is him rediscovering his emotions.
Why, though?
Yeah, see, that's the part I don't understand.
I understand what's going on, you just don't get why it's supposed to matter or why.
Yeah, like, I don't know why they did it, because I never saw Spock as being a character who was terribly, you know, troubled by his emotions. I mean, he definitely had issues that were unresolved.
Yeah, but no more so than were, you know, unmanageable.
Yeah, it's just weird that at the start of this movie he gets rid of all his emotions, and then the rest of the movie is him getting his emotions back. And it just seemed like...
We also get in the boy's home, don't we?
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, well, he doesn't complete the Kolinar ceremony ritual because, you know, we see that he's all doing his, you know, meditative thing, but then he keeps looking up at the sky, and we're, you know, into the idea that he's hearing or sensing the Voyager, the V'ger thing. And so he probably was, you know, doing practices and trying to get rid of his emotion and pretty much mostly succeeded, but then she's like, it was also weird to me because was it Dame who was the Vulcan priestess, one of the dames or something, but she's like, give me your thoughts, Spock. And then she goes, oh, I sense this thing is calling to you. You haven't attained Kalinar, you know, too bad. And they all just walk away and she drops the thing on the ground. I always took it like he was just kind of like getting his black belt in logic. I mean, that was the way I took it. Like it was, you know, he was going to go like, you know, go full on Vulcan, go do the ritual, become master of logic and no emotion. But dang it, here comes that cloud. And, you know, he has to go off. And then there is that residual, because when he first shows up on the Enterprise, he's in a cool, crazy black robe. He cut his hair at some point because he's back to the bowl cut. But he's like, you know, not acknowledging his friends and it's being all aloof and weird. And then
so he's just being a douche.
The whole
he's being more Vulcan than now because he feels like he's gotten dissed by Vulcanism.
Yeah, he's
now
like
amongst the humans, he's gotta be like, yeah, I'm totally Vulcan. Yeah,
more so Vulcan
than you'll ever be. Well,
and like, it's just weird that he's acting so differently.
Never go full Vulcan.
It just seems weird that after Star Trek has been off the air for so long, that when they brought back the characters, they decided to make Spock act so differently because of this.
Especially when he was such a popular character,
yeah,
and was so popular for how he was established. Why mess with that?
And for a reason that wasn't really important, right? Like, if the end of the series, Spock had been suffering some kind of emotional crisis, I could have bought it, but he wasn't. So it was like they manufactured a problem to give Spock an excuse to act differently and sort of jar my experience.
That's kind of the big problem with this movie, though, isn't it? It doesn't really tie together very well.
Bob, you're giving me the disapproving look. Explain yourself.
Giving everybody disapproving looks.
Disapproving looks from Bob.
So all through TOS, we have Spock being kind of jived at by McCoy and vice versa for, you know, over the concept of emotion, right? You know, Spock is half human and, you know, mm-hmm. McCoy tries to draw that out of him, as does Kirk and such. But all through the series, there's always that undertone of Spock would prefer to appeal more to his Vulcan side. You know, no emotions. I don't want this emotion business. Logic is kind of where it's at, guys. I want to be all about the logic train.
Mm-hmm. He wants that.
Now we see in this movie, his opening sequence is him now completing this ritual where, yeah, I'm finally going to be rid of all these emotions. I'm going to be like this Vulcan. It's going to be rad is what it's going to be. That, but, you know, a whole, like, space outreach thing happens and he doesn't get it. So as the movie progresses, you know, Spock is there to try to get his own stuff figured out. He wasn't there so much to be like, oh, yeah, I'm totally going to help Kirk and crew. That's what I'm going to do. It's really more for Spock.
I'm here for all
right.
When he got on board the ship after that really goofy-looking transport thing came and dropped him off.
Oh,
God,
yeah.
That was really goofy-looking. Anyway, so, and this is epitomized that he is there for himself when he goes and does his spacewalk. When he nerve pinches the guy, he puts the suit on, and he leaves. And then Kirk finds out later, oh, he left. We should go find him, because I didn't want him to leave.
Yeah.
So, right? So, and in the sickbay sequence, after Spock is found, he drifts back through the orifice thing, and Kirk picks him up, and they bring him back on the ship. So we see right there that Spock has figured it out. Why, you know, he feels the emptiness that he felt kind of at the beginning of the movie, after the whole Kalinar sequence failed on him, and it was epitomized right in the question of, is this all that I am? Right, because V'ger is a lifeless machine that is on the cusp of sentience, but it can't get there because it doesn't have that emotional connection. That's what Spock figures out right there in that sequence when he grasps Jim Kirk's hand and says, this simple feeling is beyond V'ger's conception. V'ger doesn't know what this is, this feeling right here. And that's when we see Spock's character arc kind of come to an end sort of in the motion picture, because Spock's figured it out at that point, because he spends the entirety of TOS trying to get things figured out because he wants to be a Vulcan. He wants to be as best Vulcan as he can be. And then in motion picture, he's just like, oh, well, being Vulcan is cool, but there's more to it than that. Mm-hmm. There's more to me than just the simple, dispassionate logic.
Mm-hmm.
There is so much more to it. So, is this all that I am? No, I can be more because I have these capacities. I need to use these capacities. And so even elaborate even on a little bit more in Undiscovered Country.
Yeah.
When him and
Valeris,
they're in quarters, Valeris. And you know, Valeris is like, but logic, and he's just like, you know, logic is only the beginning understanding is kind of after that. And that's what Spock figured out in the motion picture, is the understanding part of it. Because he had logic kind of all figured out and worked out up at that point.
Right.
So it was. And he was going through that Kalinar situation. And then, as soon as he mind-melded, he had it figured out. He knew what V'ger was lacking, and thus he knew exactly what he needed to do in order, and he embraced, you know, those emotions. I mean, granted, we didn't see, like, emotional outbursts or anything like that later on in other TMP movies, but he understood. He got it. And I thought it was a really well-done character arc because of that.
So now that we've got the really serious stuff about Spock's arc as a character through the movie out of the way, can I ask a question?
Grace, you can always ask a question.
Do you think Kalinar involves a colonoscopy?
You know, that's the reason why it's such an unfortunately named ritual.
The visual is there, so...
I mean, there's a definite purging going on
what
here.
What else is being purged there?
And Bob, in respect to what you just said, Bob, I understand that that's what they were trying to do. I don't understand why Spock had to go through this purging of all emotions thing at the beginning to make that happen. Because, again, I never saw Spock as a terribly emotional character. Like, in the TV series, especially towards the end, he seemed pretty balanced with himself. Like, he didn't seem like he had this problem of having too much emotion. It kind of came out of nowhere. Yeah, what was that?
It didn't seem to me that he was like, I'm burdened by too many emotions. When it seemed like, you know, I made the joke of getting the black belt, but it seemed to me to be presented as this is something that Vulcans do. Like, it's not necessarily a rite of passage, but it's like a, because she says on this, you know, we see that he's at, like, whatever, I don't know if it's at Vulcan or a certain spot, but there's these big, giant, tall statues of the Vulcans. And it one thing that was interesting is in the regular edition, we get a shot of the giant statues, and it looks like there's focuses on one that's in, like, a big robe, and then you could see that the people are really small down by the feet of that. But then in the director's cut, it's a different angle, and there's a giant statue that's holding a Lerpa. So I just thought that was one interesting difference. But she says, like, on this very site, this is where our ancestors purged emotion and dedicated themselves to logic. And so now, you know, you're going through this ritual, and here's your medallion, you know, your thing to symbolize that you did it. I took that as it's something that all Vulcans, or at least most Vulcans, would do to, like, become masters of logic and, you know, go full-on Vulcan.
Yeah, but he doesn't have a full Vulcan ancestry, though.
That's true.
Remember, he is half-human.
Right.
Remember that. Right. So, and this is kind of, I mean, I think you can see it from this angle as well. I mean, the Worf very much had this thing where he is, you know, full-blood Klingon, but he was raised by humans. So he is very much of two worlds, you know, in that sense of upbringing. But Spock is literally of two worlds physiologically, right? Mm-hmm. So he's got the human part of them, and he has to find his own way, as it were. He can't be just all Vulcan all the time. You know, just in the same respect, he can't be all human all the time.
Right.
You know, as much as he doesn't even want to be all human all the time. He has to make his own way, right?
I did think it was a little bit...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, it's a little sad for all the other Vulcans where they're like, we need this emotion to be a real life form. They're like, what about all those other Vulcans who don't do that and did go through with the Kalinar? Are they not real people? They're going to be real sad to learn that.
Well, that's just great. All that work they put into. I'm going to go tell them that was for nothing. You jerk.
Yeah. All right. So
maybe the idea could have been executed better, but I kind of took it like that because... If being, like, from two worlds, we saw that, you know, going back to the animated series with Spock's childhood and then the movies, it's shown that he could have, you know, decided I'm going to be just, you know, going the human way or going the, you know, trying to balance both. But a lot of times it showed that he chose to be a Vulcan. Like, he wanted to grasp onto and embrace the Vulcan side. And maybe because he was half human and half Vulcan that he would have, like, yearned for, like, wanting to go the extra step of doing a ritual that maybe not all Vulcans would do. It's like, I got to go do this, you know, Kalinar to make me that much more Vulcan. But then we see that even though he did that, he realizes right at the last minute, like, no, that's not my path. I need to go find out, you know, what else is out there and, you know, figure out the answer to these questions of the probe thing. So I don't know. I thought it was interesting and kind of added to Spock's path and arc of, like, going so close and then not like choosing the path, the other path right at the last minute.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe if it had been worked more into the story instead of all happening at the beginning, I can't say it worked for me, but clearly there's room for debate on that one. Can we talk about Kirk?
We could.
Cause okay. So with Kirk, like, it's like Spock was acting a little weird. I just really don't like the way Kirk is written in this movie. Like, especially in the beginning half, where he's just kind of stupid. Like, it's like, we have to go to warp right now to get there faster. And it's like, Captain, the ship could literally blow up if we do that. And he's like, yeah, but I'd rather do that than take 5 more minutes to get out of the solar system. I mean, you know, they got from Earth to Jupiter in like 2 minutes. Getting out of the solar system is going to take maybe another half an hour at most. But he's just like, nope, we have to go to warp. And apparently he didn't read the technical manual, so he doesn't know that the Enterprise, that the phasers are tied into the engines, which is a really important thing to know. And there's just all these sequence, and then, like, his whole, when he runs down to, like, take over the transporter, when the, you know, when the they're having that transporter accident, because Kirk is such a well-known transporter operator, it's just, like,
yes, I know.
It's like, why isn't he letting somebody else do that? It's to the point, and especially the way he acts afterwards, he doesn't seem terribly broken up about it. It was like, did he do that on purpose? Like, did he kill that Vulcan dude so that he could get Spock back? I mean, I'm so confused, and I really don't like the way he's written.
Well, he's kind of a little bit racist because, okay, Spock is gone. He gets this other Vulcan to be the science officer. Once that science officer dies in that weird, you know, transporter accident thing, he's telling Decker, I'd like another Vulcan at the science station.
That's
and
racist.
Decker's like, well, we don't have any
it
others.
It is kind of racist, so. Isn't it?
It's very racist.
He always wants a Vulcan at the helm. But...
Oh, no, wait, you're the other one.
Yeah, and like...
Well, they all look alike. Well, oh, sorry, wait. But and at that moment where the transporter is going bad, it's like initially Yeoman, or not Yeoman now, but Rand is doing the transporter, and Kirk and Scotty like rush into the room. And so I thought, okay, cool, Scotty's on the scene. But then Kirk pushes Rand out of the way, says, let me do it, and starts doing the controls. And I'm thinking, you got Scotty right there.
Yeah.
I mean, you think he would know what to do.
There's only one instance I can remember, which is actually the animated series where Kirk is like, big wing, beam it away, and then he shoves the transporter chief out of the way to do it himself.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I get.
It has to be the Kirk show on the Enterprise, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, like, Kirk has apparently been captaining a desk for 2 years, is the plot of this movie.
He really just wants to get in there.
So, like, I get that he wants...
He's gonna be proactive, even if it kills people.
I get that he wants command of the Enterprise back to the point where he's willing to bump the ship's actual captain out of the way. But I don't understand why someone with all his experience is being... Like, if anything, you would think he would be less hot-headed than he was in the show, because he's had theoretically, another 2 years of being out there. But instead, it's just like... It's like he... Hang on. Sound issues over here. But anyway, it's almost like he doesn't care. And there's just like everything.
Well, and then maybe it because he was sitting at a desk or being admiral for that much time, like he's itching to get back into it. And Decker makes a statement when Kirk tells Decker, like, I'm taking the center chair, I'm taking command. Decker goes, you know, back when you recommended me for this command, you said, like, you know, you're envious and you wish you could find a way to get back, you know, in command. And now I guess you found your way. And then McCoy is like, you're pushing, you know, you're trying too hard. You're pushing your people too hard. I kind of took it like, you know, Kirk is not out of his element, just because, okay, he doesn't know which way to the transporter or which way to the deck he has to ask an ensign and doesn't know the engines and all that. But so it's not so much, but he's out of his element because he's, you know, supposed to be his first best destiny is as a captain. But because he's been away from it, like he's off his game, like he's not in the flow anymore. And that's when it takes him a while to, like, you know, not be a curmudgeon, not be like too arrogant. And
yeah,
I don't know. It just seemed like he was not himself.
And I mean, the idea of the story where Kirk is trying to get command back, I can dig that. It's just there are certain things that happen that make me wonder if he wasn't taken off the ship for a reason, you know? It's like he, it's almost like to the point where he was kicked upstairs because he was too famous to fire. is what was making me wonder. And that's, you know, I didn't like that. Now I do like later in the movie he gets better. Like, you know, the whole part where he epic bluffs V'ger is probably the best part of the movie outside of the opening sequence. What is it with Star Trek movies and having really good opening sequences and then, you know, that don't follow up? But, like, that's just a, you know, that part of his character I don't think is very well written. And I don't think his rivalry with Decker is fully realized. Like, there's an idea there, but it just doesn't work out as well as I think it could. I'm not really sure what the solution there was, but it just feels like they raised this idea of Kirk and Decker having some kind of animosity, and it kind of went away without a whole lot of resolution. What about the rest of you guys? Yeah. You have anything more to say on Kirk?
Not really? No. Sorry.
And of course, yeah.
One can only sit behind a desk for so long and not romance women and get antsy.
That's probably true. All right. So, and then, like, the other characters are barely worth mentioning because they get about three lines between them. So I'm just gonna move on. I'm gonna talk about the new characters who get more time than all of the other other side characters put together. Those are Decker and Ilea, and God, I will be happy if I never have to see these two characters again.
Well, you won't.
That's true, until we do this movie again. Because, like, all right, so Decker, when he first shows up, I was kind of like, all right, maybe I'm going to like him?
You know, that's actually an interesting point you raised, because V'ger is still on its way.
Can we
the universe. In the JJ-verse.
Yeah. Theoretically, we could, in fact, see them again. But all right, maybe since we, despite my best efforts, we ended up at the 1 hour mark and we're about half done. I think we will take a short music break, if that's okay, David, and then we will come back as soon as possible. Back here on All Things Trek, talking about Star Trek the Motion Picture. So, when we left off, it was time to talk about Ilea and Decker, and as much as you guys might wish, that has not changed. It is still time to talk about them.
Yay. Yeah.
Decker unit? Or no.
Right. I hate both of these characters. I hate them all so much. All right, let's start.
Now tell us why.
I will, Grace, thank you. Let's talk about Decker for a minute.
Just call me Graham.
Like, at first, I thought, okay, he's fine. He's the guy to make that Kirk is, you know, threatened by, whatever. That's fine. You know, he was correcting Kirk for being an idiot, which I didn't much care for, but at least he was being smart. But I realized as the film goes on more and more, he looks at everything with this kind of puzzled expression. Like, he doesn't seem to know what's going on, like, ever.
Maybe his face got stuck like that.
It's just something I noticed. I was like, what's up with his expression? He's just got this weird expression on his face, like everything confuses him. Which is maybe not...
Well, I always kind of wondered about his... Okay, they make it out like he's, you know, super familiar with the new Enterprise refit. He knows all the systems. But I always kind of wondered, is this his first command? Has he what kind of experience out in the field or out in the world does this guy have? And that's maybe why, if he hasn't really done much, then he's like puzzled by everything.
Yeah.
It's good to know Starfleet is saying their best and brightest out.
It honestly, yeah, he did kind of feel like a preview of Captain Harriman, you know, just like...
Herman was Decker 0.0, who knows?
It's just like he just doesn't know what's going on, and like when they finally get up to the cloud, he's the one who constantly needs to be reminded that V'ger could crush them at any time, so trying to take offensive action doesn't have any purpose.
How did this guy make it through command
That's what
again?
I'm wondering. Again,
Yeah.
I do not like Decker. And then this segues nicely into how much I don't like Ilea. Because, like, I don't understand what is supposed to be happening with Ilea, because they mention, hey, our new navigator's coming on. She's a Delton, which I guess is Starfleet code for super fine. Because all the male crew members, which is most of them on the bridge, suddenly go like, ee, and they smile like a bunch of teenagers being told, like, a hot teacher is coming to town.
Oh boy, hot
And
substitute.
it's just like, it was like, what? And then she finally shows up, and I'm like, I mean, I'm not gonna say whether or not she's attractive because that's not really my place, but it's not like I'm not perceiving this goddess of beauty that they all kind of acted like she was gonna be. And then she immediately introduces herself with this vow of celibacy, and we never find out what that's about. And she has this.
That's
Well,
not
and
really a
that.
great icebreaker, is it?
And then
If
she makes
the
eyes with Decker, and her make eyes at each other, and he says he was stationed on her homeworld or whatever. But it was weird to me because, like, in ret after the fact, and like with the expanded universe type or whatever, the novels, and looking at Memory Alpha, there's all this information about the Deltons that was just totally lost in the movie. Like, to my memory of it, we've never seen the Deltons before. We've never really heard about them. So it's not like saying he's a Klingon, and then people like either act in fear or act happy or whatever it is. It's like nobody knows who or what the Deltons are about. So why do they all smile? What's
Because
her
sexy new
celibacy
alien
thing?
species.
Yeah, I mean, it's
He,
like.
Kirk is around. He just is magnetic to sexy aliens, so.
Yeah, I guess it's like. What is attractive and what isn't is obviously a very personal thing, right? Like,
It's pretty subjective,
but
yeah.
the character of Ilea is not comporting herself in a manner that makes me think that all these guys would be super into her. Like, there's a certain amount of, you know, there's a certain amount of the way you hold yourself and your body language, and the character is just not doing that. She's playing very cold and very standoffish, and so it's just weird.
Almost Vulcanish.
Yeah, to an
Yeah.
extent. And she has this like this random I can stop your pain power, so maybe she's actually Cybok, you know, beta test. But she only does it once. It never matters again. And when she does it doesn't make any sense because she waits for the actual doctor to show up with her painkillers and is like, no, I got this. You know, as opposed to doing it before the doctor showed up when it actually was
She
too
just really hates doctors, I guess.
Well, and it didn't have, it Chekhov's hand got injured or burned or whatever when the probe was sending their lightning bolts to all the stuff, and Decker's like, "Don't interfere," which is like, "Duh," and Chekhov's like, "Of course, absolutely, I'm not interfering." And then his hand gets burnt, and he like sits down on the ground, so his hand is actually like damaged, burnt, injured, whatever you want to call it, and that's why they call for medics. So she's just sitting next to him for what, 2 minutes, like a long time. Before she's like, oh, I could take away his pain. She should have did that right away, but even then, it doesn't heal his hand. Like, his hand's still messed up and needing the medical treatment. It was just weird, and we never see it
Yeah,
again.
it doesn't ever come up in
And.
an important manner. It's like they set that up, and then the scene where it actually affected something was cut, is kind of what it feels like. You know, it was like a Chekhov's gun that they never fired, if you'll pardon the pun.
Oh.
When did Chekhov have a
You
gun?
know, I just wanted to say really quick that the Bob in the chat room is not me.
That's true.
Okay.
It's not. It's a different Bob.
I was wondering.
But the
Well, and
in the chat room right now.
I looked up the Deltons, and it says that, you know, they consider humans to be sexually immature, and because of their high degree of sexuality, that's why they take the oath of celibacy. I don't know where I got the if it was from a novel or maybe fan fiction. I don't know. There was some way where I thought supposedly their own high degree of sexuality like influenced others around them, and in a way that's why all of the guys started smiling. But then that's why like I took an oath of celibacy. I'm not gonna influence and take over people, you know, ravage or whatever.
It's
But
code for you
all
can't
this
handle
information
this.
about so yeah, it was just like Delton,
I think
really?
that's
And
all
apparently
from.
there's been a couple other Deltons,
I think
but
that's from Gene Roddenberry's novel, as I recall. I think that's where most of that material comes from. But I could be wrong. You know, you'll, and the another thing about
Scott, Trey brings up a great point. How are the people who are watching the movie in 1979 supposed to know that? It's like they don't.
Right, that's part of the problem, right?
The movie is trying to broaden their minds, I guess. Not doing a very good job, but okay.
And, like, Decker and Ilea have some kind of history, and we never really find out what, but, like, that relationship that they had at one point is a huge part of the movie, because when Ilea Bot comes back, they're like, hey, Decker, if you flirt with her enough, maybe she'll help us. And it's like, I feel like I am expected to care about this relationship that was never established between two characters I barely know, one of whom has only been on screen for about 5 minutes total before getting zapped away by a cloud. And it's just like, why on earth would I care about this sequence? It's boring, nothing is happening, and we're referencing a relationship I never saw. Like, if this...
Right, and we only get... Hmm? A glimpse of it, because there's that one scene where she's like, how come you never said goodbye? And he's like, if I said it, would you have been able to? And she's like, no, and walks away. It's like, what am I watching?
Man,
what
it's
happened?
Troy Riker season one. Oh my God.
That's exactly
I just figured it out.
Oh man.
Congratulations. You get a gold star. You know, if this had been between one of the canon characters, I at least would have cared a little bit, because I know who they are. Like, if this had been, you know, Chekhov and his girlfriend, who was supposed to be in the show but never actually showed up. Or no, she did. She was in Waiting, and I just wanted to forget. or, like, Uhura and some guy that she'd been seeing, or any of the other canon characters. But instead, it's between two completely new characters talking about a relationship that we don't know anything about. And it's just, you know, it's just like, I have no idea why they thought this was a good idea. Like, I think it was because these two characters were supposed to be for Star Trek Phase 2, and they were, like, going to be introduced as new television characters, and they were just like, yeah, let's stick them in the movie. Why not? We'll make the movie almost entirely about them. And...
Joy.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it almost seems like, I don't know, what is it, a MacGuffin or something? I forget the right one for it. But it basically is the premise that he has to connect with the bot and awaken all
MacGuffin.
The, like, oh, memories.
Mm-hmm. Grace, I'm sorry, what were you saying?
She's the MacGuffin, I guess.
She is. And there's another thing. Did you notice that in this movie, before they even get to the big conclusion, three people die and no one seems to care? Like... You know, you've got the two people who died in the transporter accident, which is, like, the most meaningless deaths that have ever happened. And then Ilea dies, and, like, I guess Decker is supposed to be upset, but nobody else seems bothered. It's, like, I mean, you remember how much everyone lost their collective minds in Star Trek II when Scotty's nephew died? That was, like, an emotional thing. Oh, that was like, oh, God, a character is dead. And this was a character we'd seen way less than Ilea.
Yeah.
And it was just like, but in this movie, people die and nobody cares.
Consistency.
It's
inconsistency.
Yeah, I hate these two characters. do we have anything more to say about
Wait, you actually hate the three characters, because there's Decker, Ilea, and then Ilea Bot.
God.
So that's technically with her little blinky light thing on her neck. Did you love that scene where they put the headband on her and she's like, Ilea used to wear this, and that was supposed to, like, reawaken memories, and it was weird.
Yeah, it's
she's a wardrobe empath.
It's just, you know, again, it's all focused on this character that I don't know anything about, and it's like, we have to rediscover the character of Ilea within this machine, and it's like, I have no idea what Ilea's character is, other than a vow of celibacy that she loudly proclaimed. So, you know, this doesn't really matter to me. Whereas if this had been any of the other canon characters, I would have at least been somewhat invested, because I care what happens to them.
The other thing I noticed and thought about that is, like, we get the Ilea bot, and it's a mechanism, and there's that scene where Decker is, like, still making eyes at the Ilea bot, and Bones is like, Decker, this is a mechanism. Like, what? Okay, that was just weird. But she's a robot thing now. She's like a probe, you know, and she doesn't act any different than the original Ilea. Like, she was so robotic beforehand that now that it's a Ilea bot, it doesn't seem that much different. It, now she just has the blinky light on her neck. It would have been more a little more interesting. She could have been a little done better if she was like more personality, more, you know, natural or something. And then the Ilea bot is the cold robot type, you know, but it was just weird how
there was potential there that they didn't go with.
Yeah, I mean, again, that story's not inherently a bad one, but the fact that it's all about characters that we have no context for, like, you know, that's the problem. Like, the other movies, for the most part, when they introduced a new character, they spent time building them and then had the conflict centered on one of the existing characters. But this movie decided not to do that. And then at the end, when Decker decides to, like, join with the machine, it's like, I don't understand why he's doing that. Is it because he thinks he's going to be together with Ilea? Because they failed to make that clear, if that's actually a thing that will happen. And so it's this big climax, again, about a character I didn't like.
And it even brings up weird notion of, like, it's almost like, you know, they had a thing, they went their separate ways, now they're back, and then Ilea quickly gets killed and replaced with this bot. Mm-hmm. And there's that one scene where they're, you know, examining her, and McCoy is like, you know, microprocessors the size of a molecule, and like everything is perfectly reproduced, and that's why they're thinking maybe her memory engrams are also perfectly reproduced, and we could trigger her memories and, you know, friendship and loyalty and all that. So, okay, that's one side of it. But is it Decker in awakening the Ilea personality, the Ilea matrix, like before and Data, whatever? Like, is it a scenario where he's thinking that, okay, it's a mechanism, but it's so perfectly reproduced that really is Ilea's, like, memories and personality, and it almost is Ilea, so I'm going to go off and be with her. That was almost creepy. Like, that could kind of be similar. Like, what if a person had a loved one, mm-hmm. you know, a spouse or a mate, that mate gets killed, but then there's a clone.
Yeah.
Are you going to immediately just go like, oh, I'll just be with the clone version because it has the same memories and the same personality?
God, you just described the entire plot of one of the older X-Men story arcs.
I'm sure that they've done that plot.
Cyclops just has his girlfriend cloned.
Oh no. Well, it's weird. I mean, it's a interesting, weird, creepy idea. Like,
yeah.
Obviously you're never going to get the original one back because they were killed, but does that, you know, it's like trans.
Sorry, what was that, Grace?
Right.
Unless it's Jean Grey, then she's back every 10 minutes.
Well, that's just how the, you know, the Marvel Comics universe works, right?
Just a lot of transference. Like, he knows it's a probe, he knows it's a mechanism, but it still looks like Ilea. It feels like Ilea. I'll just go be with Ilea bot over there on the V'ger thing.
Yeah, and it's a thing where, again, if that had been a character that I liked, we could have had this whole is it really Ilea thing, but they don't do that very much. They don't play it up. It's more that he's just trying to trick her into giving them information by awakening these feelings she has.
Which is pretty manipulative.
It is, and there doesn't really feel like there's any genuineness to it.
It makes it even creepier.
Yeah, a little bit. All right, I want to talk about V'ger for a bit. I want to talk about the villain of this movie. Which is like, I mean, I can't summon the same, like, hatred for V'ger that I have for Ilea and Decker. Like, I guess, you know.
Are they perhaps the bad guys then of this film?
They're my bad guys. My own personal bad guys.
Your personal antagonists.
But V'ger itself is like, it's okay. I mean, I thought they did it better in Changeling. Like, you know, V'ger is similar to, but legally distinct from Nomad.
Legally distinct.
Like, you know, you have the probe that is now superpowered. I don't understand why a creature with such perfect logic couldn't figure out why its creator wasn't responding. It's like, oh, maybe it's because it's 300 years later. Like, it's
not so much perfect logic as it is just ego.
Yeah, it's like, they say it's a perfectly logical machine that doesn't have emotion, but if anything,
V'ger is trying to find its god. And, you know, is your god dead? If your god is dead, how could it have created you? Because you're such an awesome being, your god must be perfect.
But see, that's the thing. If V'ger is a creature of pure logic, like they say, why is it looking for a god?
It doesn't use that terminology of God. I mean, it uses the creator, but the creator must be better than V'ger. And as far as V'ger is concerned, it's the hottest thing in town.
But see, that doesn't sound very logical. That's part of my problem with V'ger, is that they say that V'ger is a creature of pure logic that needs to learn emotion. But if anything, based on the way it acts, it's the other way around. V'ger is a creature of pure emotion, pure immature emotion, that just lashes out at everything it sees and wants what it wants and doesn't care what's in the way and doesn't understand why it can't have what it wants. It just wants it. V'ger, they say V'ger is a child, and that's true. V'ger is a tiny baby in a giant spaceship.
V'ger gets what it wants.
But V'ger is not a logical creature like they keep saying. What V'ger is a purely emotional creature that needs logic. And if they had played that up, that could have been brilliant. But they're playing it in the reverse. Like, everything they say about V'ger is completely counter to the way it actually acts. And it's too bad, because they were playing up this whole Spock-V'ger story that never went anywhere. And if the story had been about Spock teaching this immensely powerful being certain elements of logic to control its emotions, now that would be a movie I'd love to watch.
Yeah.
But that's not what we got.
Again, this movie has so much wasted potential.
It is. At least with Nomad, they had the excuse of Nomad was damaged. The probe was damaged, so it didn't really have complete data. But V'ger is just the Voyager probe. It is a perfectly intact Voyager probe sitting in this giant alien spaceship. So it's not like its data's been corrupted, as far as we know. It knows everything the probe knew. It's just, for some reason, these robots decided to build a giant ship. We'll never know why they did that. Maybe it was to provide a boss battle for Star Trek Online. Who knows?
I was wondering if that would ever get mentioned.
Yeah. And then there's the whole retro retcon or the whole Borg aspect. I know that it was just weird.
Yeah.
I never really got all that.
Right, exactly. That's my problem with V'ger, is that V'ger, the way that it actually is portrayed is opposite of what they say it is. And if they had portrayed it better, I would have probably liked its story more. Now, that said, I never get tired of watching Kirk outsmart computers. That's a thing he does, and I need that as an ego booster, because I'm terrified of computers. So
watch you operate one, I'll tell you what.
You
just gotta fight that Windows 8, Orin.
I need the comforting lie that humans will be better than computers, in the future.
Do you know that we have prototype autonomous killbots now?
We totally do. I mean, computers are gonna be better than us at Go soon, okay? That's like the last big thing that we can do that they can't is Go, and they're gonna beat us soon.
I'm just gonna go comfort myself by watching iRobot again, then.
Or just, any of the Star Trek episodes where Kirk, logics a computer to death. I love watching that as much as the next guy. But this particular way they did it was just kind of boring. All right.
How could logic be boring, Orin?
I can't imagine.
In the chat room, Make Tina War and then Sun Seal says that Voyager went through a black hole, so maybe that could have scrambled some of the circuits and logic.
Maybe, but...
Processes
damn
or whatever.
Unpredictable black holes.
I find it unlikely, because they're clearly operating on
the
theory... So what was that, Chris?
Or it just made it American for a little while.
Yeah, who knows?
And that stupefied it or something.
Well, here's the thing about the black hole. They're clearly operating on the black holes are wormholes theory, because if this was an actual black hole, it would have been crushed and spaghettied and destroyed, and not there would be no trace of it remaining.
Spaghettied is a verb?
Yeah, spaghettify. But
or maybe it would have gone into the black hole and then came out the other side in the JJ verse.
That's possible.
Singularity.
That's going to be the plot of the next Star Trek movie, I guess.
But the probe...
Things just falling out of black holes.
But clearly the Voyager probe itself was actually not damaged by going through this black hole. And I mean, maybe the black hole damaged its programming, but since it didn't damage the outside at all, I'm going to guess not. And we'll never know for sure, because they never ask, right? It drives me nuts when characters don't ask these questions, that at least at that point I would understand it's supposed to be a mystery. But, all right, shall we move on to our last segment, which is dialogue and plot, which we've already gotten into somewhat.
Ooh, okay. All right.
So we already mentioned, I love McCoy's dialogue in this movie. McCoy is like a breath of fresh air for me. Everyone else is talking and it's slow and pondering and I don't really know what they're saying. And then McCoy comes along and is like, I was scared out of my wits, Jim. It's like, the engineers, they love to change things.
They love to change things.
Just like, McCoy, why aren't you in more scenes? Come back, McCoy. No, don't leave.
I wonder how much of that is to be credited to the writing and how much to DeForest Kelly just being awesome.
Yeah.
That's what I couldn't help but
like. There's also that scene where, like, you know, Kirk is asking, does the new sick bay meet with your approval? And he's like, it does not. It's like working in a damn computer center. And so it's like McCoy's not happy with all the, you know, new technology. He'd rather have his, you know, old school doctor lab.
And, I mean, just McCoy, like you just pointed out, Grace, DeForest Kelly is just a fantastic actor. And the inflections he puts on everything just makes them work. But unfortunately, I think he's the only character that's well-written in this movie. Because, again, like, the dialogue so often does not really match what's happening on the screen. And that's one of the classic examples of bad dialogue. Like, you know, it's hard to pin down exactly what makes dialogue good and what makes it bad, but I'd argue that if the characters...
Now, right there is a case study in what makes dialogue bad.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, because the other characters have so few lines, like, it's hard to really get a sense of what they're all about in this movie. And a lot of the lines that Kirk gives are just very strangely delivered. Like, again, that was why I was getting really confused around the transporter accident scene. Because, like, just the way Kirk is acting there is sort of making me wonder if he didn't maybe have a little more to do with it than he's having us led on.
Well, and there's, like, you know, the main characters with their dialogue, but then there's like the Starfleet people and other stuff. In the beginning, there was that Epsilon 9 station that gets, you know, zapped by the V'ger after the Klingons. And they're the ones that, like, you know, they get the transmission from the Klingons and that's where they go like, oh my God, it's 82 AUs. Oh wait, no, it's just 2 AUs.
Some number of AUs.
But then there's this one. Right.
Pretty big discrepancy between 2 and 82.
Well, there's this one woman that's like, you know, one of the main characters we see on the Epsilon 9 station, and she's talking to the other guy there. But at one point, I guess it's a guy, there's like a guy floating in a suit above the station, and we hear her voice over the comm. And I don't know exactly who she's talking to, but she mentions like some kind of scout vessel that maybe, but she says, like, we're changing our frequency, it's about the communication. And she goes, how read you this? And it's like, I'm thinking, is this like weird backward talk? How read you this?
Did Yoda write
it's like
this?
Saying, I know it was weird. Like, okay, you're changing the frequency, you're changing channels or boosting your signals. Like, how do you read, like, can you hear us basically? Is like, you know, can you hear me now type of thing? And she goes, how read you this? I'm like, what? Is that how they talk in the, or is she just being weird?
Look, it was she's instant messenger shorthand before it was cool.
What was that, Grace?
She's actually a Shakespeare enthusiast.
It's look, when you get on that little list,
she was doing Starfleet in the park all weekend.
When you're on that little, you know, listening post for, you know, 6 years at a time, you start to get a little squirrely, you know? No, and as for...
She was just trying to kick things up a little.
And as for the plot... I mean, we've touched a lot of this already, but it, you know, it depends on a lot of really silly ideas, like the Enterprise is the only starship in range, even though it's A, at Earth, there are no starships at Earth, and B, it takes three days for them to get to the cloud, or for the cloud to get to Earth, and Spock was able to make it all the way to them from Vulcan in a shuttlecraft.
With really big freaking warp nacelles.
Yeah. Which, I mean,
it's a shuttle with warp nacelles.
I get that that's a special shuttle, right?
Both shuttles are hyper, you know, hyper... what am I trying
hyper
to say?
Hyper fast.
Yeah, hyper good. Better-est.
Better-er.
According to Make Tea Not War, how read you this is actually a traditional radio phrase. What do I know?
You have no chance to survive, make your time.
traditional internet phrase right there. But like,
it's the phrase of our people.
Like, obviously, they make really fast shuttles on Vulcan, but it really, you know, just makes you wonder. There was no other ship that could show up to help them out. I mean, and especially since
not even a Not even a little Miranda? Come on. They're all over the place, right?
No, all those Mirandas turned tail and ran. Like, the moment they saw it, I was like, there's a giant thing coming towards us. We've got to get out of here. We don't want to be the guest casualties.
You got to remember that Mirandas are like the prey that wander around the savannah waiting to get pounced by the cheetah or the lion. I mean, you saw what happened to the Saratoga as soon as the mama lion probe got on it.
I'm now that imagining a bunch of Klingons coming up over the horizon.
Miranda's scatter across the plain.
And
the circle of life.
And like I already mentioned that the movie is done kind of, it has a weird structure to it because the really exciting part happens at the beginning and then it's like just not exciting after that. And you
downhill from there.
You know, and like I'm not saying that every movie has to be made a certain way, but traditionally you save the exciting part for the end. That's sort of the tradition, and I don't think it served them well to break that tradition in this movie. I don't know. The only part that I really enjoy, other than the beginning, is when Kirk bluffs V'ger, and it takes forever to get there. Grace, we haven't heard all that much from you. What did you think of the plot in this movie?
I haven't seen it in a long time, for one thing.
Oh, gosh.
Sorry.
It's all right. It's okay that nobody but me and David did their homework.
I've been a busy week. I got stuff to do.
Bob, what about you? Thanks. How do you feel about the plot of this movie?
I thought the plot was, it was a good plot. However, the presentation of it could have been better. I mean, a good example being that the fun, exciting part of it was in the beginning when we see Klingons shooting torpedoes at clouds,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, which actually kind of sounds par for Klingons, really, when you think about it. But, you know, yeah, if there's something more Klingon, because the next kind of climactic part that we get is when, you know, Aliabot, Decker, and V'ger are all just, like, mashed into whatever new life form it is that comes out of this thing.
Yeah.
That's kind of it, right? Then it's just like, yeah, we're totally just going to go off now and do our thing in space. Later, guys. Yeah. Later, Earth. So if there's something a little more climactic that could have happened somewhere else in the movie, I think it would have been better. Because
that wormhole sequence wasn't a good. I mean, it was high pace, and oh my god, we're in a wormhole. Okay, sorry.
I felt a little bored and sleepy by the whole sequence just because of the way everyone was talking. You know, play that phaser order. You know, it's just I wasn't excited by it. It wasn't very exciting.
If I ever have kids,
that's a ship sway motion. It looks like that would make people sick.
If I ever have kids, that's how I'm gonna put them to sleep. Is I'm gonna play them the wormhole. I'm gonna play them the wormhole sequence. I mean, and then the way the movie ends, the way it actually ends, is that V'ger explodes. Maybe, I mean, no one's exactly clear.
They witness the birth of a new life form.
And you know, Kirk.
It was an explosive birth.
Kirk has Ilea and Decker marked as missing because he's a huge optimist. and then he says, set a course that-a-way. And he literally makes, like, the hand motion. He's like, that-a-way, where he's, like, just sort of waving his hand. Like, he just doesn't care.
You want to blow this popsicle stand.
And it's like, don't you need to go back to Earth? I mean, this thing...
Kirk, out!
This thing was firing giant energy balls at Earth. Maybe you should go check if everyone's okay. You know, I mean... Don't you need to be debriefed after a mission like this? It's like,
meh, he's Kirk, nope, like, makes his own rules.
I got my ship back. Let's go second star or third star. You know, let's just go third see what's out there.
Yeah, I mean, in the end of Star Trek VI, he does something similar. And in that movie, they're clearly going, you know, to have sort of like a, you know, to have like a bit of a joyride before they get decommissioned. And at that point, fine. You know, they've taken care of all the loose ends by that point, right? But in this,
that right there is a big group midlife crisis of joyride, I think.
Yeah, a little bit.
A little bit.
And it's just sort of like, what, you know, it's just a weird way to end the movie. And I guess they're trying to go for, because you know how a lot of the TOS episodes had like that little funny moment of them all like yucking it up on the bridge. And I guess that's what they were trying to do here. But, you know, it doesn't work in a lot of those episodes. And it certainly didn't work in this movie. And, like, it was funny because when I started watching this movie again, I was like, a lot of people have been saying that the movie is better than we all thought and that we need to give it a chance. It's got some cool ideas in it. And I was like, you know, with the benefit of hindsight and perspective, I'll probably like this movie a lot more than I did the first time. And I was like, no, I was terribly wrong.
I might have noticed some of that stuff the first time around if I wasn't so bored.
It's like the second time is so much worse. Actually, it's way more the second time. I've watched it like 3 or 4 times now. But, you know, I hadn't watched it for several years, and now I did. Okay. So, guys, do we have any closing thoughts on Star Trek, the motion picture?
I think the...
Well, I would...
Go ahead, David.
Go for it. Well, I was just going to say real quickly, if you're going to watch it again, there's, like we said, there's the different versions of it. Don't see the theatrical one, because that's probably what everybody knows and remembers. But I would say watch the director's cut, at least, or the remastered, because I watched the director's cut, and there's little scenes, like when, you know, some of it is just, in a way, could be filler, like, you know, when Kirk arrives in the shuttle at Starfleet Academy, you just, like, see the shot from inside the big room with all the people walking around and his shuttle lands. In the director's cut, you get a couple quick little scenes of the shuttle from a distance flying over the Golden Gate Bridge, and then there's it goes, you know, closer in, and you see the shuttle going towards it. And it was just a little, nice little visual to see the Golden Gate Bridge and the shuttle flying over it. But I could see why that would get cut out. Then there's other little scenes where it's like maybe, you know, 5 seconds or 10 seconds, but there's dialogue in there. So I would say if you're going to watch it again, check out the director's cut. I don't know what's totally different in the remastered. So that's the thing where I kind of want to see the remastered. Me and Oren watched the director's cut. And then, Bob, you said you watched the remastered one, or you at least have it. What's the big differences between those? You mentioned that they changed the V'ger to look more like a ship, but is there any other significant, noteworthy changes from...
It did a lot of higher definition stuff, more computer animated stuff in there. I mean, a lot of the models weren't really touched all that much, but just sharper, crisper.
All right. So, Bob, what's your final thoughts on the motion picture?
I think it was a really good film in the respect that it set what the visual standards were going to be moving forward for ships. Because, I mean, well, we all remember the sequence where Kirk sees the Enterprise refit, right?
Yeah.
Now, that style of ship.
Definitely.
You know, the way it's structured, its curves, was, while it retained a lot of the same characteristics as the older Constitution that we saw in TOS, it was very much an updated version of it. I mean, not like, it wasn't a jump from, like, what we have now to, like, a JJ ship, which is really dumb looking.
Yeah.
You know, because it's all proportioned to hell. But it was a really good update, and it really had an impact on what Starfleet ships were going to look like later on. Plus, in addition to, and David, you were kind of saying this earlier with the Klingon ships, there's all these little bits of extra stuff. When we saw the flybys of the refit Enterprise, we could see much more detail on it. Like, we could see that there wasn't just one big, you know, piece. It was, you know, many little pieces were put together to make a huge structure, is what it was. You know, so yeah, it was additional details, and it really, I think, set the tone for what we saw, you know, in Star Trek 2, Star Trek 3, 4, 5, 6, TNG, you know, that that ships aren't just pieces of plastic put together, but they are huge structures made of all sorts of different polymers, graphites, alloys, all this stuff, you know, that's put together, and it's truly a complex machine.
Right, and I guess that's another thing that I completely forgot to mention, is at the beginning, that Kirk's in this huge rush to leave, but first he takes like 10 minutes to get a good look at the Enterprise. And then why is Scotty shuttling Kirk around? Isn't he needed on the Enterprise? That's still,
I guess he got demoted.
He's still like the chief engineer. Why isn't he helping fix the ship? all right. Okay.
Yeah, that was weird. Well, I did want to mention the Enterprise, and I did enjoy that long sequence. It kind of, I mean, I think those little shuttle pods could probably move faster than what they showed, but to get there quicker. But I did enjoy the scene. It was a big introduction because it is a new Enterprise. You know, it's the Enterprise that we see from this movie, basically all the way till all of the movies of the original series, and then until we get to the Generations, which gives us the Enterprise, the Enterprise B. But so we're going to be with this ship for several movies. And I think it was a good introduction to the new refit Enterprise and launching the movie Enterprise, you know. But I also just love the ship. I love the design. It's very staying true to the original, TOS version. But the angles, the lines, the everything about it, I just love the Enterprise A. And so, you know, it was just a beautiful ship, and I enjoyed that sequence. And like you said, even the Miranda classes and a lot of the other ships take over or, you know, follow that design. Mm-hmm. So I dig it.
All right. Well, thank you, Bob, for joining us again. I hope you guys will join us next week when we discuss Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Electric Boogaloo.
Yeah, well, that too. And now, David...
No, that's Into Darkness.
If David would be so kind, he will play for us Data Logan's voicemail.
Direct from the database, it's Data Logan's data log.
One is my name. The other is not.
11 October 2013. Some of my random observations about Star Trek, the motion picture, which came out December 7th, 1979, when I was 2.5 years old. Boring. Bland uniforms. Crotchety old doctor. Bones' beard. Big 70s mustaches. On Scotty. Another other guy that Spock nerve pinches. Giant Vulcan statues? Torpedoes. Away! Really, I think the movie had a lot of interesting ideas. It was just a bit ponderously done. But it's good stuff in there. Meaning of life. Spock realizing that pure logic is not enough. I mean, really, this is the beginning of the cool, more balanced Spock that we see in all the later movies. You know, one who's willing to use logic and also his human side. I enjoy the fact that there's no real bad guy to the story. V'ger's just misunderstood. I was always sad that the movie was never followed up on. You never got to meet this new being ever again. Well, unless you count a really crappy Star Trek Voyager comic book, and maybe some passing references in novels. Still, I felt the story was done better and with more depth than it was done in the original Changeling episode. It was Mr. Plinkett on Red Letter Media who really pointed it out to me, but this movie is all about sex. I mean, you have the early version of Riker, and then you have the early version of Troy, and they previously had some kind of sexual relation, probably, and they want to have sex again. There's the talk about oaths of celibacy. Interesting that it's not oaths of chastity. Klingons trying to penetrate clouds. The Enterprise actually does penetrate the cloud. There's a hot-looking robot probe from the aliens, and Decker has to try and seduce the probe. Spock goes out in a thruster suit to enter through a sphincter into a long corridor right into Ilea's center. Decker and Ilea and V'ger all merge into one new creature at the end, birthing a new species. There's even some Spock-Kirk homoerotic scenes. It's amazing that it's the only Star Trek movie that got a G rating with all this sexual tension all over the place. But then again, the PG-13 rating didn't exist back then, and things were a little different in the movie industry. The shower scene in the movie was actually supposed to be a nude scene, but Persis Kambata was not willing to do it nude, so they had to add a robe to her. She was supposed to step out of the shower nude and then put the robe on, but she refused to do it, so they had to put the robe on her inside the shower. It ends up looking like the robe was just transported onto her by some kind of technical mechanism, which is sort of interesting. I liked a number of the little small things that happened in the movie. I liked the wrist communicators. I liked the guy that's standing on the floating platform up on the bridge doing maintenance. I liked the little monitors that are on the people's suits that track their something. I liked all the aliens and the diverse crew when the crew all gets together on the wreck deck to have their briefing. I liked the starship porn, at least the Klingons and the Enterprise. Maybe not so much V'ger, because you saw so much of it. I liked the new Klingon makeup. I liked the new Klingon language and the new Vulcan language. The novelization was interesting. Written by Gene Roddenberry, it revealed some tidbits about Kirk. How he entered the Academy on this special program that the Academy was trying, where they were allowing people of lesser intelligence to enter the Academy, or people who had lesser test skills. Because Starfleet was trying to experiment with the idea that maybe it's not such a good idea to be chock-a-block full of perfect people. Maybe we'll take some people that aren't so perfect to diversify our crew. And then the idea was that Kirk was one of those first young people coming up who wasn't as perfect, and that somehow enabled him to be better than all of his peers in some important aspects and to become the youngest captain in the fleet. The novelization also establishes that Kirk has a communicator planted inside his head to receive top secret information from Starfleet directly. Man, that transporter accident was pretty gruesome. You don't get to see anything, really, but just the sound effects just made it horrific. Deep Door His Musma. Data out.